Accession number 20456, wheel 28.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 28. You were describing how you were chased in an eight-wheeled armoured personnel carrier.
Oh, yes. I knew that across a particular field was a stream with a wooden bridge. And I'd been over it in the car before. And I reckoned that it'll take the Capitan, but it wouldn't take the APC. How right I was. He didn't realize it. He went into the ditch. He couldn't get out. Last thing I saw was a furious officer standing waving his fist. He got clean away. I almost ran out of film. I've never had such a haul. And it was the first time we had seen this thing out of Russia.
You mentioned that there were restricted areas, permanent restricted
yes.
areas. What would they constitute? Would they be permanent?
They were what you might call tank training areas, field yes. firing areas,
yes.
where, like Senelaga, like Katrick, like the place up north on the A66, where, you know, sort of it was used for live ammunition, and clearly they did not want people mucking about in there.
What about temporary restricted areas? What would
they were when they blank off a bit of the countryside for an exercise, and I never knew whether to this day we never quite worked it out whether some of it was total bluff. All the missions were given it at once, you know, to distract your idea from something going on somewhere else. Yeah.
Did they ever invite you to go and observe training or exercises in
nope.
progress?
No, not in my time. I believe they did afterwards.
I think that came along when they started developing confidence-building measures
that was
as
it.
Part of the
yeah. Yeah.
conventional disarmament program.
Correct.
Did the Russians, to your knowledge, ever undertake measures, deliberate measures, to try and deceive you about what they were doing? You mentioned they used the restrictions possibly as a bluff, but did you come across proven cases where they were trying to lead you astray or bamboozle you?
No, I don't think so, not really. No. No.
One question that occurs to me is why they didn't actually follow you all the time you were in East Germany. Or did they? Did
please.
They try and...
Well, yes, you see...
keep tabs on you.
The Volkspolizei produced a, like most police forces, a check on foreign missions to make sure that we obeyed the rules. As our espionage activities got more and more daring, so they bumped up their surveillance. For example, opposite our Paris, there was a little sentry box. There was a Volkspolizei sentry in the box with a telephone. And he would report on every car coming in and going out, so that they had a mission, they had a control center, so they knew. First of all, the cars having gone over the Gnilinka Bridge, so the checkpoint there, they knew what cars had gone into East Germany. They knew where they were, particularly if we called in the mission house. So that they were able to intercept at any time. There were only about four routes out of Potsdam. If they thought they wanted to, they could put a car straight on your tail. And these were initially clapped out things like Trabants, you know, and the hope of following Capitan. But then they had BMWs and things. They were a very different kettle of fish. Of course, they had wireless, you hadn't. And one of the ways you could escape them was getting into the woods, because we had so much better maps. And we four-wheel drive, and they hadn't got four-wheel drive, we could usually lose them in the woods. Or you could lose them in towns. But they were a bloody nuisance. On one occasion, they were off me, and I got in the wood, and they didn't come close up to me. They thought they'd got me fixed. But I'd got myself on a bit of wood with a bit of a hill. And so we gave them an hour to, you know, sort of relax and do nothing. We had a lunch. And then very quietly we let our brakes off without starting the engine, you know, and scooted off down the hill. And of course we were away before they had the slightest idea of where we were.
Who were the people who followed you? Were they part of the Vox Polizei? Or
they were Vox Polizei in civilian clothes, but they had their uniforms with them. But they couldn't technically touch us.
They could just watch what you were doing.
Well, I mean, they could block you, you know, and all the rest of it. Then call the Russians. But technically speaking, you see, the East, we didn't recognise East Germany.
They had no legal status.
They didn't exist.
You're saying they were in civilian clothes. Did you wear uniform all the time?
We were in uniform all the time. Mm. Oh, yes, no way were we allowed to wear civilian clothes.
Were you ever armed on these?
No. That was strongly forbidden. Of course, you're saying they were. The other people you see who were armed were the forest guards.
Oh, yes, the Forstmeisters.
Forstmeisters. Yes. They're all ex-soldiers. They were a nice lot, actually. But the trouble was, they were linked up with the police. I mean, your railway guard in East Germany is armed. Your police are armed. You're armed. An armed sort of...
A heavily armed society,
yeah,
generally.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any contact with ordinary East German civilians?
Yes.
How did you get on with them?
Splendidly, you know. They were so pleased to talk to you. I never forgot one splendid character who appeared with a tractor. We were sort of having, in a wood, having sandwich lunch, and this chap appeared and said, "Oh, British Army." And so we said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, I was captured by the British Army in Crete. I was a parachutist and spent most of the time in the Delta, you know, carrying places." And it came out that he disliked the Russians intensely, disliked the East German intensely. And we said, "Well, why don't you, you know, come over the border?" And he said, "Well, why should I?" He said, "Here is my family land, which I farm." And he said, "I look after it." He said, "One of these days these bloody people will go, and it'll be all right." But he said, "I have to be very careful what I do and what I say, because it costs a fortune to, you know, replace parts and things. And I have to give a third of my crop away to the bloody Russian army." But and he said, "They're not so like me." Yeah. And we used to go, I mean, those... The three sea paintings.
Yes.
I got in Leipzig, they're East German.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you ever have anything to do with making contact with agents?
With?
Agents.
No. Yes. Strongly, that was absolutely strongly forbidden. You were going to be in very deep. One chap tried to escape and got through our lavatory window into the palace. It was a frightful hour. I forget what happened to him. We were on no account did we have anything to do with that sort of intelligence.
Did the Americans and French operate on the same basis as you did, with the same sort of modus? You mentioned the Americans only in twos, for example.
The trouble with the Americans were they were a bit what I would call gung-ho.
Yes.
You know, you had to go to places that other people hadn't gone to, and you had to see things. We used to change sectors, and from time to time, you'd come in to take over the American sector that was buzzing with bloody vofos and traffic. And they stirred it up. You then discovered that some tour had done something stupid, you know, not necessarily stupid, but something we wouldn't have. We stalked them rather quiet, much more quiet there. The French, I think, had a great deal of agents on the ground. I suspect that. They never proved it.
Well, you mentioned they're dealing with the man in the signal box.
I know. Well, I'm sure they dealt with other people, but...
Would they have been people, do you think, recruited by them while they were
yes,
on tour?
I would think so.
On a purely
local. So. I would think so. Yes. So the French and the Russians had a very interesting relationship. The French were much closer to the Russians than the rest of us were in some ways.
Why was that?
You've got to go back to history. After all, the language of the Russian court until the revolution was French, basically. No one talked about the Russian, a horrible peasant-bloody language. Mm. And the French produced the engineers that built places like St. Petersburg and,
How many teams did they have, the French?
No, nothing. You see, the French were bigger. We had 31 passes.
Yes.
The French had, I think, about 22. The Americans only had 17 passes. They were late on the scene.
So they had smaller resources.
They called you, therefore they told us only two people in the car.
Yes. Did the French go around with three in the car or two?
No, two.
Two?
Usually,
so it was only the British who had three per car?
Yes.
Yeah. Did they use the same kind of vehicle?
But, I mean, we had a tremendous liaison with the missions. Both on all rank sides, mm-hmm. Yes.
Did they use the same Opel Capitan car as you used?
No, I forget what cars the French had. The Americans had cars of their own. I can't remember what cars the French had. But we we reckoned the Capitan was the best buy we could get.
Was all the information gathered on tours pooled?
Yes. Oh. Yes. Mm. Very much so. Mm.
So where did it go then? I mean, you were reporting back to Rheindahlen, but obviously Rheindahlen wouldn't be handling French and American material.
No, the whole mission report actually went to the three headquarters concerned.
Yes.
I mean, it was a combined report from all three missions. Went to Rheindahlen, Baden-Baden, and
Strasbourg, presumably.
That's it. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
The French. What sort of officers did you have in your team? And
perfectly ordinary.
Mm. How were they
selected? Some like John Cormack had done a year's course in Russian.
Yes. Mm. What sort of qualities do you think made a good member of Bricksmith?
A sort of poacher, really. We had all sorts of types. Did you see the raising of the Rary Rose when the cable went, there was a ping,
and it tipped
well,
over
the
again.
Well, the engineer officer who was in charge of that was John Chitty, who was one of our more successful officers, chap who's just been ambassador in Bonn, Nigel Broomfield, was one of my tour officers. These are pretty high-grade lot. They were very specially selected, but I don't quite know by who.
Presumably the military sectors department would have been in charge of it.
Half of them were Russian speakers.
Yes.
Trained.
You mentioned that you actually had the first sighting of a new sort of Soviet armoured personnel carrier when it deployed into Germany. Were there any other significant events or developments occurred while you were there running Bricksmith?
Yes, well, I mean, this chap saw...
this is John Cormack.
The Harrigan, the gun.
Yes.
Which was the first sighting of that, which was a sort of gun plus mortar. Mm. And then we had the newest Russian aeroplane that disappeared into the harbour when I was there. That was really quite something. I mean, it had not been out of Russia for more than a fortnight, and we got the bloody lump. That was quite something.
Were there any major... increases in the size of the GSFG while you were there?
In the
were there any major reinforcements of the Russian forces in Germany while you were there?
No. No, we didn't have any sort of international nonsenses, nothing like that.
What was the sort of overall atmosphere like in Berlin at the time? Was it a tense
great
atmosphere or a relaxed atmosphere?
No, it was great fun. Mm. It was like being in India in a garrison town before the war. Mm. Well, you made your own amusements, you had a very close circle of friends. There was no question of the army sort of, as it does today, pack up on a Friday at lunchtime and go home for the weekend. Nowhere to go. So, you know, the games and everything else went on the weekends. Mm. I mean, it's the highest morale I've ever come across for a long time.
It does sound rather like a cantonment.
Exactly. Mm. You've described it in one word.
Mm. I mean, did you ever get any alarming indications from what you saw on the other side, indications that the Russians might be planning to do something?
Not while I was there. Mm. No. No, the tense time was the aeroplane. They thought, until we handed the two pilots' bodies back, they thought that we might have they might have survived and they might have been prisoners and being interrogated, and that made them very twitchy.
But you weren't involved in that directly, was there?
Yes.
Oh, were you?
I had to go to Zossen and explain to the Russian commander-in-chief why we couldn't hand him, give him his nice new toy back.
What had happened to it?
Well, it went into the river. Mm. Both engines flamed out.
So it was a mechanical failure?
It was a mechanical failure. He tried to land it in the big lake, the Wannsee. Unfortunately, the bit he chose was in the British sector. So the Russians couldn't touch it. They could go in the bank and watch what was going on. Little did they realise what was going on.
So what happened to the aircraft?
The aircraft eventually, having been taken to bits, very cleverly taken ashore without anyone seeing, and examined and put together again, was handed back to them. It took about a fortnight.
So what happened when you went to see the Russian at Zossen? Did you...
Well, you know, one was marched in front of the commander-in-chief and told that we were, you know, behaving disgracefully, and, you know, and if anything went wrong, it would be our fault, etc., etc., etc. And, you know, one said, well, we're terribly sorry, it's your plane, went in the wrong place, it's in our sector, we'll recover it when you get it back. But it's very difficult because it's in mud, it was. He wasn't pleased. When we came out of the office, Nigel Broomfield, who was my interpreter, said, well, you know, that was rather like getting six of the best from the headmaster. Whereupon Pinchuk, who was the Russian colonel at Serb, said, what was that? What was that? So we didn't tell him.
You didn't tell him?
No, well, I did, only he'd have understood. Mm. That was quite a drama, the aeroplane one.
Did you have other dealings with very senior Russian officers?
Yes, indeed. From time to time, there were border not contraventions. What do you
incidents?
Illegal border
crossings.
Helicopters, aircraft. On one occasion, the East German River Police made a nonsense of it on the Elbe, and I had to tell the Russians that if they proceeded to do it again, we would shoot them out of the water with tanks, and they didn't believe me. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, Monday morning, 11 o'clock, our buoy marking ships, which you have, the Elbe was navigable,
yes,
and the sandbanks changed, and you had to, you know, send out your surveyors. And I said, if any East German police boat tries to interfere, it will be sunk by a bloody tank. And the chap said, but Gosling Brigadier, you wouldn't do that, would you? And I said, we certainly will. We've had enough of it. Now, the thing was...
What have they actually been doing, these German
Well, they were roughly trying to stop our river police marking the sandbanks. Ah. You know, perfectly normal, just putting up, you know,
navigation aids.
Marks. Anyway, at 11 o'clock on the Monday, a regiment of tanks deployed on the riverbank, not one East German boat was seen. And the marking, I think, ever happened again. And it was very clear to us that the Russians did not realize what the local East German Gauleiter had been up to. He'd obviously exceeded his powers. About 3 weeks later, there was an article in the Czech press about goings-on the Elbe and how the beastly British had brought up tanks to terrorize local populations, etc., etc. And we all said, well, wait for it, you know, we'll be summoned to Zoss, and so I was. And it so happened that that time I was wearing my kilt and my interpreter was a Scot, in fact, Royal Air Force, and the wittiest protest ever was read out. But the Russian translator got it wrong. And instead of saying Britannskaya, he said Angliskaya, in other words, English.
Not British tanks, not British, English tanks. Yeah.
And the very nice General Chief of Staff, Cherentayev, said, now I've got some regular, very serious protest. Will you deliver that to your Commander-in-Chief? Now, normally speaking, one usually said, well, it's nonsense, isn't it, you see? This time I knew that Gotham, and I said, with the greatest of pleasure, you see. And the chap looked as if he'd been shot. And he said, what do you mean? And he said, well, he said, you can see that I've come from Scotland, and my interpreter's also Scottish. And he said, we've always had trouble with the English, just the sort of thing that goes on, you see. Whereupon he roared with laughter, and he put his hand on my knee and he said, Gosling Brigadier, you and I understand each other. He knew very well that the whole thing was a load of Codswallop. We then heard the local Gauleiter had been well and truly sacked, and the local East German army commander had bloody well been sacked too.
So they didn't want trouble on
the So you see, I mean, the Russians did not like their Germans any more than we did. Mm. Oh, yeah. Are you going on to the final thing in Korea? No.
When you went back from Bricksmith, what do you think you'd learn from having run that particular outfit?
I learned a lot about diplomacy. And I learned a lot about East-West relationship. Because I'd never served in Germany before, and I'd never served anywhere near the Russians. One learnt a lot about the Russians.
Now you'd come up against the Chinese in fighting, hadn't you?
Well, no. I mean, fighting, yes, but I mean, that was a rather long range. I found the Russians fascinating. They were much more like us than we would pretend. You can translate an English joke into Russian and a Russian joke into English, and both will be still funny at the end of it.